It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. In Syria, the headline says, bodies pile up as UN consensus for action remains elusive. That pretty much sums up the situation there since the beginning of the so-called Arab Spring in December of 2010. The Assad regime remains in place despite demands from a number of world leaders that it step aside in favor of free and open elections. But is Syria ready for democracy or for civil war? Does the opposition party have a plan for after? What is the solution for ending the violence and killing in Syria? What should the U.S. role be? And where is Russia in all of this? We're going to talk about that this hour, and we welcome your thoughts, ideas, and questions as well. Here's how to get in touch. The phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and there's a Kathleen Dunn Facebook show page that you can leave a comment on or a question as well. My guest this morning is Joshua Landis, Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. His blog about Syrian politics and history is SyriaComment.com. Good morning, Professor Landis, and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Good morning to you. It's a pleasure being here.
Now, I read one headline in the intro, and here's another. I think this one's from the LA Times. Gestures of censure on Syria show world's outrage paralysis. Does that pretty much sum up where we are right now?
I think so. The international community does not want to get directly involved in Syria, militarily involved. They're trying to stoke, they're trying to get weapons and money to the opposition, hoping to overturn the regime that way and putting very severe sanctions on the government, starving the government, feeding the opposition, changing the balance of power that way. But they're not going to invade.
But when we say opposition as if the opposition was sort of, you know, united, monolithic, but what we've seen is that there are dozens of different militia groups. And we're what, trying to figure out which one we should back?
Absolutely. You've this is the main problem. The opposition is in emulous factions, and the United States doesn't really know who to back. And that's one of the main reasons why the West has been so cautious, I think, in approaching this Syrian revolution. The Syrian National Council, the umbrella group that Hillary Clinton had been dealing with, the president of it just resigned. Lots of recriminations. It's in fragments. There are supposed to be elections next week to nominate somebody else to be head, but we'll have to see how that works out. But on the ground, as you say, in Syria, 50, 60 different militias, and the CIA is now trying to make contact with them to figure out, you know, who are friendly, who is not friendly, because the last thing that the U.S. wants in, you know, shoveling arms into getting the Gulf Arabs. Now, America is not putting the arms in. They're doing non-lethal aid. But they're trying to direct where the arms get to and help the Saudis, because they do not want to produce another bin Laden or another al-Qaeda, as they did in Afghanistan when they shoveled arms into the opposition there to bring down the government. So they're trying to figure out who's going to be a winner and who's going to be friendly to America.
Well, that's always a gamble, and we don't have a very good track record of picking the right one, it seems.
Well, I guess we've been a little bit hard doing that in Afghanistan and America, but it's not easy. The situation is that Syria, in many ways, has a very weak national political community. It's not really a state, and that's why this civil war, incipient civil war, is broken out and trying to create a George Washington for these nation states and to build nation states, as we've tried to do with Karzai in Afghanistan or Chalabi previously, now Maliki in Iraq. It's not guaranteed to work.
Well, let's back up the truck just a second and go over some historical ground. Syria is another one of those Middle Eastern countries that sort of was created out of the leftovers of the Ottoman Empire, and I don't want to go all the way back to World War One here, but in the British and the French and whoever else divided up the Middle East after World War One and created these states, and I don't know that there was a whole lot of rhyme or reason to it, but Syria was created, and is that in part kind of the root of some of this? I mean, we threw a bunch of people together who didn't get along anyway, and we expected them to become a Western-style democracy?
Well, that is the root problem here. The whole Levant, whether it's Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Palestine, all of these countries were cut out of whole cloth, out of this multi-ethnic Ottoman Empire, a lot like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, where Central Europe was cut out, and it's been the source of both the First and the Second World War. Creating nation-states out of multi-ethnic empires is not easy to do. It hasn't been easy in the Middle East. We can blame it on the British and French, but there was no good way to chop up the Ottoman Empire and create nation-states. And the line was drawn around these various religious communities, Alawites, Druze, Christians, Sunnis, and they're stuck together. And they haven't found a way to create a nation state and to create a national community to live together. We've seen that in Lebanon, where there's been a 15-year bloody civil war, in Iraq most recently, where the United States has stuck the Shiites from on the top of society and cast down the Sunnis to the bottom. And in Palestine, where Jews and Muslims have been in each other's throats for the last, you know, since the state was created. And Syria is, one had hoped that Syria would be different. But the Alawite minority, 12% of the country, dominates in the security forces. And they were the Alawites were the lowest of the low in Syria, the poorest, most discriminated against community in Syria when the French arrived there in 1920 and took Syria really as a colony, as a mandate, until 1946. And the Sunni majority, the Sunni Arabs, 65% of Syria are Sunni Arabs. The Sunni merchant elite, the notables in the major cities, rose up against the French almost immediately and said, "No, we don't need to be run by a bunch of Europeans. We're a mature society. We can run ourselves. Get out of here." And they began to shoot at the French. The French, in order to destroy this nationalist uprising, put together an army. And into that army, they recruited lots of minorities and poor Sunni Arabs from the countryside who would be willing to shoot against the notable elite. And Alawites from the west coast to the coastal areas of Syria, who were very poor, signed up in droves and were over-recruited for this military. This created a situation at independence in 1946 where the Sunni notables were left in charge of a parliament and in charge of Syria, but they inherited a military that was loaded with minorities and poor Sunnis from the countryside who disliked those Sunni notables. And this was an explosive situation. The first coup d'etat in 49 brought the army to the center of stage in Syria, and there were a series of almost 20 coups and failed coups over the next 20 years. And the Alawites, officers in the military rose to the top, took over the military in the mid-60s, 66 in a big coup, and took over the country as well. 1970, the last coup, the Assad family, an Alawite family, consolidated power around its own family and the Alawite minority. And that's been the way power has been structured in Syria ever since. Alawites at the top, the Sunnis in alliance, Sunni notables in alliance with the Alawites, but the Alawites have been ruling the country, and the minorities in many ways have had their foot on the necks of the Sunni majority for the last 40 years.
How united is the Sunni majority? It sounds like that's pretty factionalized as well.
Well, it is, and that's the problem. You know, if the Sunni majority had been united, this regime would never have been able to rule for 40 years and wouldn't have been able to take power. It has survived because Syria is fragmented, and it has used divide-and-rule tactics, and it has been strong because it relied on traditional loyalties, family, sect, in order to rule Syria. And in many ways, this revolution, the Sunnis, which is almost uniquely Sunni Arab, against this Alawite regime, puts the country in front of a big challenge, which is to unite as a nation and to overthrow this very narrow regime and to create a new state that is predicated on democracy and brings together the nation as a whole. And that's not happening. And that's where the foreign international community is so challenged, because they've tried to do this in Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya, overthrow dictatorial regimes, and then with the idea that somehow a nation is going to grow up and form a nice, friendly government, and there's not going to be oppression, there's not going to be dictatorship, and that hasn't happened so far. And so I think America's a bit shy. The Western Europe is shy. They've faced failure in Iraq and Afghanistan, or what some people think is failure. And they don't necessarily want to get involved in Syria. They want to help the Syrians overthrow this regime, but they don't want to take responsibility for the outcome, because if it doesn't work out, it's going to be very expensive.
Well, and I mean, one of the things here, one of the differences between Libya and Syria is that Syria doesn't really have anything anyone wants. There's no oil there, for example.
Well, I guess that is an element in it. There is a lot of oil in Libya. Libya is only 6 million people, and the regime was hanging by a thread. If we recall, you know, Benghazi, half the country had hived off and joined the revolution. Ambassadors, foreign ministers were defecting within weeks of the... So the Gaddafi regime was just hanging by a thread. And America realized that if they just huffed and puffed, they could blow its house down, which they did. Now, it took a little bit more than they thought it would, and U.S. air power got involved more, and special forces got more involved than they wanted to get involved. But ultimately, Gaddafi was brought down and killed by the rebels after America had flattened his military and bombed the palace and so forth. And that's not quite Syria is a much bigger country, 24 million people. It's turning into an ethnic civil war, and the opposition is very fragmented. And if you just bomb the hell out of the, you know, we could use our air power and bomb the hell out of the presidential palace, the military implantations, put special forces on to, you know, shine their little red lights on things and blow up tanks and trucks. We could do that. We've done it many times before. But what would you have, would there be a unified, would the situation get worse? And would a civil war break out with all these militias fighting to get to the top? And if it did, and the death rate went up, and we didn't stop the killing, then America would be on the hook trying to nation build. And that's, I think, what Obama is really frightened of here.
Let's, I think we're going to go to break here, and I want to ask our listeners to get involved in this discussion. I'll just toss out this question to the listeners. What do you think the international community in general, and specifically the United States, should do here? What do you see our role as? Would you support the use of our military to go in and try and straighten things out, or do you think that's a bad idea? Let us know. Here's the phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. There's also a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can leave a comment there if you so desire. So lots of ways to get in touch. We'd appreciate it if you would take a moment and share your thoughts on the situation in Syria. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 21 minutes past 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. Mitt Romney looks to the Lone Star State to push him over the top. Republicans rally a week before the recall in Wisconsin, and after five terms in Congress, Thad McCoder can't gather enough signatures to get on the primary ballot in Michigan. After one on Talk of the Nation, the political junkie Ken Rudin joins host Neil Conan. That's coming up after 1 o'clock today. This hour, we're talking about the situation in Syria, specifically, what should be done? What should be the U.S. role? What's going on over there, and why is this so complicated to why is this such a complex problem to solve? My guest is Joshua Landis, Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He has a blog about Syrian politics and history at SyriaComment, all one word, SyriaComment.com. The Saudis are the big Sunni power in the region. Have they picked out a particular Sunni faction to support in Syria? Who do they like?
Well, that's a good question, and we're not sure. They are the main backers of the Syrian rebels. They promised substantial financial help. They said they would put the Syrian opposition on salary, using that word, and they are trying to get arms to the Syrian rebels. Those arms hadn't been flowing in. There were some national Syrian council people have said that they are now getting in, and the Saudis are giving them different militias into the Muslim Brotherhood, and really it's up to them. I think, as one Syrian National Council guy said to me, he said, you know, they've given these arms, they've given money, and now they've told the various militias, you know, go out and show us what you've got. And they're waiting to see who's good, you know, who can go out and shoot up the military. So we'll see, you know, who rises to the top in this, I guess, rather Darwinian struggle that's taking place in Syria, very, very brutal.
Okay. We've got callers who want to join the program. Let's start in Salem with John. John, good morning.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you. It's a great program. Thank you. I believe that the U.S. military should stay out of Syria. I just don't see how we could effectively involve ourselves in Syria and at the same time preserve our international integrity. We've already engaged ourselves too deeply in two foreign countries, Afghanistan and Iraq, trying to build nations there, and it just hasn't worked for us. It's put our nation into debt. It's destroyed our international credibility, and I don't think it's effectively changed the course of history for the better. I think that the U.S. involvement should be to try to use political pressures to gain support of China and Russia, and trying to come up with a political solution to the problem there. And I appreciate the opportunity to share a thought. Thank you.
Professor, is there a political solution to this crisis?
You know, that's the United States has been doing just what your caller suggested, which is trying to turn Russia and China away from supporting Syria and get them on the side of the U.S. in order to condemn Syria in the international in the UN Security Council. There was an attempt to get a Chapter 7 condemnation of Syria that would allow for a military force in Syria some time ago. The Russians and Chinese vetoed. America's been trying to turn the Russians away from Syria. That's unlikely. They're unlikely to have success in that at any time soon, unless the Russians really feel that the Assad regime is collapsing. In many ways, we're seeing elements of the old Cold War mentality here. The Russians have a lot of interest in Syria. Big naval base, Tartus, they're trying to refit the Russian fleet and build it again after it collapsed with this collapse of communism. Their only major base in the Mediterranean is in Syria. This is a bit analogous to the U.S. in Bahrain, where the Shiite majority is trying to overthrow the Sunni monarchy. And the United States has sided with the Sunni monarchy, just sold them lots of arms, willing to, I guess, oppress the Shiite majority in order to preserve their interests in the larger Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Sunni state. They don't want to lose Saudi Arabia, and we're not going to lose Saudi Arabia. So in some ways, that's the Russian attitude towards Syria. Syria's a longtime ally, military base. It's a foothold on the Arab-Israeli conflict, a sort of bridgehead into that, and I see it as a canary in the mine shaft for Iran. Iran is the big enchilada in the Middle East. Both Russia has interest in Iran, but particularly China. 20% of Chinese energy imports come from Iran. Lots of investments in Iran. China does not want to lose Iran, and if Syria goes down, all eyes Western eyes are going to focus on Iran. America wants a regime change in Iran. And they'll see that as undermining Chinese policy and energy imports from the Middle East and as a big blow against their interests. So Russia and China have made common cause and are trying to draw the line at Syria, thinking, you know, Obama, America, a bit weak. They've been defeated in Afghanistan and Iraq, or at least they've had bad experiences. And this is where we want to draw the line. And they're pushing back to see if they can, I guess, you know, stop America at the doors of Damascus.
Let's go to the phones and hear from Justin in Green Bay. Justin, good morning.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. Go ahead.
All right. My question is this. My question is, what role do you see the extremists, the, you know, fundamentalists playing in Syria, considering what that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is somewhat feeling empowered now being Egypt is under their, you know, watchful eye. And is that affecting the stances of other countries, Russia, China, America, the West, and everything else?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it is affecting. The big anxiety, of course, of many of Syria's neighbors and of the Western powers is if this revolution goes wrong. I mean, if everything went right from a Western point of view, from an Israeli point of view, you would get a Shiite, Alawite government replaced that has been an enemy of Israel, an enemy of the West, replaced by a friendly Sunni government that would be allied with Saudi Arabia, make peace with Israel, bring democracy to Syria, and be friends with the United States. And then the United States would expand its authority and gain power in the Middle East. That's the good scenario that everybody could dream about. The chances of that actually happening and it working out that way are not particularly good. What might happen, and what I think people fear would happen, is that you get a civil war situation that extends in Syria, lots of militias, and this opens the door to al-Qaeda, jihadists, and Salafi groups that we've already seen beginning to gain some foothold in Syria. There have been a number of car bombs blown off in Damascus and Aleppo that seem to have the imprint of al-Qaeda on it. U.S. intelligence sources say that it does. They don't have a big sway in Syria, but they could increasingly gain sway if this, as this civil war becomes more brittle, more bitter, and people need their help. So that's of course the fear, and it makes things very difficult.
Thanks for the call, Justin. Is there also a danger that as the violence escalates, the more secular Syrians, the ones who have been pushing for this revolution, and it seems like they're being pushed aside by the militia groups. Is there a danger that I hate to use this cliche, but the best and brightest in Syria are just going to flee the country? The ones who aren't into the religious extremism, they're just going to look and say, you know what, there's really nothing here for us. We're going to get out before we get shot.
Well, that's happening. There was a lot of emphasis was placed at the beginning of this revolution on trying to get the urban elites, the Sunni urban elites, to flip, as they call them, or to defect, to leave the regime, join the revolution. And the problem is that as the fighting has become more violent and more extremist groups have taken, and have been militias, it's become a real military battle. The upper classes see the potential for an Iraq-type situation or a Lebanese civil war situation that will drag out for a decade with lots of killing, and that the ideas of liberty, justice, democracy, and dignity get shoved to the background as both sides become more brutal. Upper-class people are saying, let's get the hell out of this country. And Iraq lost 2 million people, fled the country. Most of the upper classes left. Anybody who had money got out. You know, the last several weeks, I've written a handful of recommendations for friends who are academics in Syria and others who are trying to get jobs elsewhere. Most of my good friends, now admittedly they've got more money than most, have left the country. They've gone to Jordan. Several have gone to Jordan, and others have gone to Lebanon. And those with relatives in the West are figuring out how they can move here. But people are, the upper classes are beginning to think, you know, there goes Syria, and if I want to give my kids a future, I've got to get out of here.
Going back to Russian-Chinese connection to Syria, I'm trying to figure out how the influx of terrorist groups and the escalation of violence in Syria benefits the Russians or the Chinese. I mean, I would think that they would have some motivation themselves to try to end this crisis.
Well, they do, and they've, you know, in a sense, they put their money on the Assad regime, and you know, back Assad, let him put down this revolt, and hopefully move him towards reforms. That seems to be illusory. Assad isn't going to reform in any serious way, and we've seen that with the most recent party law and elections recently, which returned the same old people in pretty much everything was rigged. But that's been their hope, and not to support the revolution, but to support the regime. And America and the Western countries have taken the opposite tact, which is to support the revolution, support the rebels, and to bring down this regime. So we've got the international community is split, and increasingly that means more arms are going to go into Syria because Russia is selling arms, Iran is sending arms to the Syrian army, as the West and the Gulf countries help arms get to the rebels. So we're going to get more killing and deeper civil war.
And the Kofi Annan ceasefire, is that dead? I mean, maybe
it's
it never had life.
You know, it's the only thing in town. The trouble is, it is, you know, the United States is trying to undermine it by supporting the revolution. Russia is sending arms to the Syrian army. Both sides are, in a sense, undermining an attempt to get arms put aside and to move the military out of urban centers and to make the rebels stop shooting. It's not going to happen because the international community is doing just the opposite of what Annan is calling for. But in many ways, Annan, in calling for the end of hostilities, is playing into Assad's hands because if hostilities were to stop today, the Syrian army owns Syria. Assad owns Syria. The rebels would have no grounds on which to negotiate or bargain with the regime on because it doesn't own any territory. And it would be a defeat for them. So the West does not, you know, the West is committed to regime change in Syria. They're going to arm the opposition. The Annan plan is really about empowering Assad to, you know, if all shooting stops, the Syrian army rules Syria, and that's the way it's going to be. And so it's a dilemma. The West says they want the shooting to stop, but they only want it to stop if the regime is going to step down and there's going to be a transfer of power to the revolution.
Lines available for you if you'd like to join our discussion about the situation in Syria. What do you think should happen? What do you think the United States position should be? And just what are your thoughts, maybe your concerns about this? Here's the phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. You can also find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We have some callers on the line. Let's go to Green Bay next and hear from Saeed. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I want to talk about the role of Iran in Syria and the strategic significance of the survival of the Assad regime to the survival of the theocracy in Iran. In the recent P5 plus 1 negotiations that were going on in Baghdad, Iran came with one of the demands being that the West back off from regime change in Syria, that the survival of the Assad regime was one of the demands of the Iranian negotiators for the nuclear non-proliferation talks. The commander-in-chief of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, the bloodsuckers who in 2009 decimated the Iranian Green Movement by unrestrained violence of the type that we see ongoing in Syria, they are the ones, the commander-in-chief of the Quds Force is in Syria physically, and Iranian forces are doing much of the killing. They're also paying for much of the arms that the Russians are providing. All this indicates that Assad regime, that the Iranian regime sees the survival of Assad as critical to its own survival. And the perplexing thing in American foreign policy to me is the aggressiveness with which we stood against Gaddafi in a country where American national interest was not as much at stake, but here, where both humanitarian concerns and American national interests dictate that we aggressively oppose the Assad regime, we are rather docile in our opposition to Assad, and we and the West is tolerating a slow genocide here, and that's the only way that I can describe it. We're tolerating a slow genocide, and that confuses me. I don't understand why we would be so committed in Libya, and we are so restrained here, and how restrained we were in 2009. In the green movement in Iran.
Well, Saeed, I think you've brought up a lot of very important issues here, and you're right. In many ways, this is a larger struggle in the Middle East, and a struggle that some people have painted as the Shiite Crescent, an alliance that goes from Iran, a Shiite country, to Iraq, which is now a Shiite country thanks to U.S. Intervention there, and is allied with Iran, Shiite-led Alawite regime in Syria, and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Those four powers are allied together, and they stand against, they call themselves Resistance Front, and they stand against Israel, Saudi Arabia, used to be Egypt, Egypt's in flux now, but Egypt, Jordan, and the United States. The Sunni world, in a sense, against the Shiite world, U.S. Against Russia and China. And there are big stakes at hand. And many people, as you underline, argue that this is a golden opportunity for the United States to kick out one of the pillars of this Shiite crescent and Russian influence in the Middle East, which is Syria, the low-hanging fruit. This would break up the Shiite crescent. It would hurt Hezbollah badly in southern Lebanon. And it might be, in fact, the string that would unravel Iranian autocracy in Iran, this theocracy. So they see this as a big opportunity to give a shove to this domino, this set of Shiite dominoes. The trouble is that, obviously, America is very leery. They did manage to overturn Gaddafi very easily, and I think they did it largely because it was a target of opportunity. His regime was collapsing. Major defections from every level. Half the country fallen out of his power within weeks, and that they thought they could just go, you know, a teeny little shove, and that Europe would take the lead with NATO, and that America could lead from behind. The trouble in Syria is that people see this as a swamp, that they're going to get sucked in. And that's why none of the regional powers, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, NATO, have all stayed out. Now, the United States really wanted to lead from behind in Syria. They galvanized the international community, and they wanted Turkey and Saudi Arabia to get together and lead the way. And for a moment, it looked like the Arab League, Qatar called for military intervention. But Saudi Arabia immediately said, no, we're not going to do that, and they turned it over to the UN. Turkey looked like it was going to lead the way, but it sort of stared over the precipice and decided, you know, 500-mile border with Turkey. We have Kurds. We have Alevis, who are not the same as Syrian Alawites, but they sympathize. This is going to be a cauldron. It's going to spark ethnic tensions in Syria, in Turkey. We don't want to get into it. It'll be our Vietnam. So neither Saudi Arabia nor Turkey want to get involved. They want the United States to commit themselves to military intervention, and then they'll follow from behind. They want to follow from behind. So all the powers are sort of going, you first, you first. Syria's too big, and nobody's taking the lead. And so that's left us with this terrible situation and this, as you underlined, this humanitarian crisis unfolding before our eyes, and yet nobody wants to jump in and take charge. And you know, is the world too cowardly to do this? They probably are. But as the previous caller said, we jumped into Iraq, we jumped into Afghanistan, and it sapped us. Americans no longer have the confidence they can nation build in the Middle East. And that's where we stand today, and it's a dilemma.
We have other callers on the line. We'll take some more calls. We're going to take a short pause, and when we come back, I want to talk about the refugee situation regarding Syria. I mean, whenever we have armed conflicts like this, there are always people who need to get out or who need to be taken care of. They're displaced. And I'd like to get the professor's thoughts on that. And like I said, we've got other callers, but there's a line available for you if you call right now at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org or leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 9:44, almost 9:45, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour, we'll talk about the NCAA. Earlier this year, NCAA schools voted to end the association's ban on multi-year athletic scholarships. But the decision was controversial, and many big schools opposed the change. Next hour, I'll be talking with Josh Levine of Slate about the tenuousness of athletic scholarships in big-time college sports. This hour, we're talking about the situation in Syria and what ought to be done there, and the solutions are difficult because the situation it isn't straightforward. It's not like there's one bad guy and we go in and take care of that person and then everything turns out all right and everybody shakes hands and walks off together into the sunset. My guest is Joshua Landis, Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He has a blog about Syrian politics and history at SyriaComment, that's all one word, SyriaComment.com. Now, Professor, we talked about the wealthy and the elites fleeing the country when they saw that the situation just wasn't going to resolve itself in a way that was acceptable to them. The militias were taking over the more violent extreme religious folks were starting to really take this thing over, and they weren't going to get what they wanted, and so they started to leave. But we also have a displaced civilian population that isn't wealthy enough to catch the next plane out of the country and take their wealth with them. What's happening with the Syrian refugees?
Boy. The refugee movement is really just beginning. Economic sanctions placed on Syria a year ago are beginning to really bite. Wheat imports haven't come into the country. Food prices are going straight up. And energy has been the main focus of sanctions. So Syria isn't getting imports of refined oils and cooking gas. One of those blue bottles of cooking gas that you need butane for your stove, most Syrians use, they cost about $30 or $40 in the marketplace if you can find them. And people are beginning to cook on electric burners, and electricity is only available in most places for about 3 hours a day. There are major cutoffs because there isn't enough energy to produce electricity. So Syria is shuddering. The economy is spiraling downwards, lots of unemployment. And this is going to lead to a big, you know, if things get worse, which they're going to do, a big refugee movement. We saw 2 million people pour out of Iraq. Before that, it was Lebanon. And where Syrians are going to go is unclear. Well, they'll go to Turkey, I suppose, and they'll go to Lebanon and Jordan. Already, we believe about 60, 70,000 Syrians have left the country. There are about 10, 15,000 in Turkish refugee camps. And this the 60,000 includes the wealthier people who are leaving. But we're going to see the poor people leave eventually. Right now, they're still clinging on to the hope that things will settle and that they can somehow find their way through. But it's a grim situation on the ground with the economic deteriorating. And Syria was a poor country to begin with. 32% of Syrians before this uprising were estimated to be living on $2 a day or less. That was UN figures. Today, the Syrian pound has lost about 30-35% of its value, and so there are many more poor people in Syria and not many good prospects.
I want to go back to the diplomatic front for a moment. A number of Western countries, I think 13 so far, have expelled Syrian diplomats. The Russians are saying this is counterproductive to the Annan plan. What's the significance of the of kicking out the Syrian diplomats? Is that actually going to accomplish anything except to get a good newspaper headline?
You know, it's not going to accomplish a lot. It isolates Syria more. It demonstrates the exasperation of the Western states. But it also underlines that nobody wants to get involved militarily. They see this as unproductive for them. They want to do something, but they've raised the rhetorical bar about as far as it can go, and they've called Assad every name under the sun and the brutality and so forth. This is what's left. They've put severe economic sanctions. If they do more, you know, people begin to starve. And so what do? You kick out the diplomat.
Oh, doesn't sound like there's really any way to win here. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Milwaukee next and hear from Robert. Robert, thanks for holding.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment is this. I'm surprised the role of Russia and China intervening at Syria is bigger than we thought, because not only politically they are visiting in the United Nations, but they are providing very sophisticated weapons. And I was surprised, if you don't know the system, S-300 Gladiator is the soil-air missile with 100 miles range. That means something is going on there.
Well, I guess they're worried about air-ground support from the West, and this is a way to try to scare off the West from doing that sort of thing. And it underlines, as you say, the stakes that are reminiscent of the old Cold War struggle, which just makes it much more difficult to jump into the middle of this fray and for the West to commit themselves to the success of the rebels by putting their own military in.
Well, I'm going to put on my Mr. Worst Case Scenario hat. Is there a chance that this Syrian conflict could escalate into some sort of military confrontation between the United States, Russia, and China?
I doubt it. Everybody's staring at each other, and they're sort of gurring and showing their teeth. But Syria, unfortunately for Syria, the stakes, it's not that important a country. It doesn't have tons of energy supplies. There are lots of poor people. Nobody wants to own it. And that's why, in a sense, it's becoming an orphan. Everybody is willing to put a certain amount of energy and money into it. In keeping it boiling, denying the other side a victory. But will anybody really want to invest the kind of money to win in Syria? That I'm not sure. And, you know, that's the depressing part about it. It's certainly depressing for Syrians, because they're seeing their country is coming into this grinding, low-grade conflict that is sapping the economy, and that looks like it could extend for a long time to come.
Robert, thanks for your call. Let's go to Marty in Milwaukee next. Marty, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
You bet.
Okay. I guess I got to say, I'm going to be turning 60 years old this year, and that means that for over half of my life, maybe two-thirds of my life, there has been some country or other in the Middle East that has been throwing rocks or worse at other countries in the Middle East. Now, you understand I'm a faithful public radio subscriber, so I listen. But I got to say, there's a bunch of us Americans who are just dealing with fatigue, combat fatigue, in a sense, from a long way away. And especially in a situation where we don't seem to have a lot of leverage anyway, I guess I'm wondering how much longer will the U.S. even be able to keep its focus on the Middle East? Because this has just been one humongous quicksand muck, and it gets tiresome to look at and to watch.
Well, I think you're expressing the views of lots of Americans there. This is unpopular. The polls show that Americans do not want intervention in Syria. But if we pan out for a second and look at the larger geostrategic stakes in the Middle East is a fulcrum for international power. In many ways, the U.S. and the West defeated Nazi Germany in the Second World War by owning oil and denying energy to the Wehrmacht. And Hitler's Air Force and Panzer tanks came to a screeching halt because they didn't have energy. And the U.S. discovered that energy was the key. And in planning for the Third World War, the United States wants to dominate the Persian Gulf. That means, and oil. And that means Saudi Arabia, which is the biggest oil supplies in the world, but Iraq and Iran. And we always had Iran and Saudi Arabia. 79, Iranian Revolution took Iran out of our control, and Iraq was a misguided missile. We tried to line up with Iraq. We helped Iraq invade Iran and supply them with weapons under Saddam Hussein, but then he turned against us, and we know the history of that. But we are clinging on to the Gulf and dominating the Persian Gulf and Saudi Arabia because that's the key to the Third World War. It's the key to, in a sense, superior U.S. power over China, because China depends on the Gulf for its energy supplies. And as long as we dominate it, we're the biggest guy in town. And this is where Syria, even though Syria is not an important country, it's allied with Iran, and it gets us involved with this oil and the Gulf and our position in the Middle East. So America has big stakes here. And we would love, and I think many Americans would love, to just roll up their tents and get the hell out of Dodge, because it is a mess. And there are lots of incomplete nation states, and it's quicksand. But strategically, the U.S. is committed to Saudi Arabia, committed to the Gulf, and that means we're enemies of Iran and enemies of Syria, and we want to overturn those regimes, and that's our game plan, and Iran's our number one enemy in the world, and we want regime change there. And in a sense, we're trying to get it without getting too deeply involved, and that has us, constantly worrying about the Middle East.
I want to try and get one more call in here, but we'll have to be really quick because we're really running out of time. Andy in Lake Geneva, you're the last caller here.
Thank you for taking my call. I think the professor is spot on, but the problem is that Russia and China, especially China with its dependency, there's no question that China, Russia, Iran, and Syria have all sat down and they've made a deal against us. Okay, I mean and that deal is that there's no way that the United States is going to influence the Middle East any further than it has. There was an article in Reuters this morning where Russia and China came out and said, we're sick and tired of having U.S. values being promulgated in the Middle East. So I think, realistically, what we're dealing with here is Russia, China, Iran, and Syria, all essentially in a coalition among themselves against us, which means
Andy,
the end of the day, Syria just goes down the drain. And
right. Well, I want to give the professor a chance. I want to give the professor a chance to respond here. We've got about 45 seconds.
Well, Andy is, I think he's, by and large, he's right. I was in China not too long ago on an energy conference thing, East-West, and the Chinese, I was shocked that they turned to the Americans, the Chinese diplomats, and they said, why are you doing this to us? Why are you pursuing an anti-China policy? They said, we are lifting up hundreds of millions of Chinese out of desperate poverty into the middle class. You're trying to stop us. You are putting sanctions on Sudan, Libya, Syria, Iran. That's where we get our energy from. You're making energy more expensive. You're gonna stall out the Chinese miracle. We're doing good for the world by increasing Chinese, and you're doing bad for the world. We turned to them and said, you know, we're doing good for the world. We're helping good guys in the Middle East, and we're punishing bad guys, and you're getting in our way. And we both looked at this from completely different moral points of view. And I think that underlines this power struggle.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there, Professor. Thanks for an interesting hour. I appreciate your time today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Joshua Landis, Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Again, he has a blog about Syrian politics and history at Syria Comment. That's all one word, SyriaComment.com. This program was produced by Brett Jaspers with on-air production by Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning. If you missed part of it and want to go back and listen to the whole thing, you can go to the WPR.org webpage, look for the Kathleen Dunn Show, and today's show should be up in just a moment. Stay tuned. More to come on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.